Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
And that, once again, folks, is the delightful voice of Brian Brown, who's the founder of the Brown Briefly. Brian started the Briefly and brought his high standards of hosting, we hope, to an intelligent discussion of current events. And it's often laced with humor and we hope some empathy for the events of the day. Brian's motto was less is more, more or less, and obviously he always brought more, and we struggle to maintain that high standard. So let me introduce the Briefleys. Zooming in from his home here on Vachon above Burton is the voice of Indivisible Vachon and the Vachon Climate Action Group. It's our tireless defender of democracy who strives to create a livable planet overseen by a government we can appreciate or at least tolerate. Good morning, Kevin.
Vote. Oh,
that's it. That's hey, today. You know, yeah, I forgot
yeah,
to.
Yeah, definitely. Good to be here with you. Hold on. I need a vote. Okay. I think I got the message out. Good to be here today.
There you go. Good. And also zooming in from his home above the beach, KVI Beach, is a historian extraordinaire, skipper of the Vachon, president of the Vachon's own fantastic heritage museum. And he's our own globe-trotting guardian of the galaxy, Bruce Hallman. Hey, Bruce, how are you this morning?
I'm doing well. I hope everybody gets the write-in vote for airport commissioner. I'm sorry. No, don't.
Are you running a write-in campaign, Bruce? Is that what's going on? Funny. And right here next to me here at the beautiful JBBS studio in downtown Vachon is a former tow truck repo man. Now that's new. I had not seen the repo man part. I like that. Pinkerton guard of the Pan Am's first 747 at San Francisco. A high fashion ladies shoe salesman, which always fascinated me. Former Washington State Assistant Attorney General. Tort and constitutional law professor, two-time Fulbright scholar. Oh, my gosh, it just goes on. International arbitrator and mediator, the one and only Craig Bellis. Listen to me.
You ought to have that shoe fetish looked into a little bit.
I know. That thing fascinates me. I'm telling you, it really does.
Good to be here with the Briefly.
Thanks. And I am
true. Can I jump in for a second?
Yes, please.
I've always wondered, Craig, with being a repo tow truck driver, part of your legal training to go to law school?
Part of my self-defense training.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Cut and run.
I have a story about that myself. I am, by the way, Truman O'Brien. I'm behind the big board here at the JBBS studio. I am a former airline pilot and current flight instructor, and I even taught somebody I know very well how to fly.
Yeah, and you saw it all in action here the other day when you gave me part of my annual flight review, or biannual.
And you did, I got to say it once more, you did great. Your landings, not so much, but the flying, fabulous.
I'd landed blind. You told me I needed to do it with the hood on, so I tried to land the plane with
yeah. I think it was your shades that kept popping a lens.
That's right.
Did it to you. Hey, you know, I got one. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm glad we're on the ground briefly, inspiring confidence every day.
Yes, exactly.
That's what we do.
Yeah. Hey, I do have one PSA I got to make here. I got to remind folks that on November 16th, we have our lip sync contest for the Voice of Vachon. Doors will open at 6:30 and a 7 p.m. show at the O Space. And you can sign up on the voiceofvachon.org and vote on, I think we have three videos so far.
Have you seen the videos by any chance?
I have not. I've been too darn busy.
You've got to see them.
Yeah, I'm going to.
And I'm somewhat biased. You have to see our executive director. She has one on there that is fantastic.
I did see part of that.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, yeah. And it, you know, she, I think she filled in at the last minute for somebody else. And,
yeah, she did.
And she commented the other day. She goes, you know, it's not as if I don't love doing these.
Oh,
things.
Yeah.
It's pretty obvious.
Yeah. But also, if you would like to perform live, where you're still are looking for live performers to perform during the November 16th event, and it's a lip sync, so, you know, find your favorite song and put on some crazy clothes and come down and sing, or lip sync anyway to it. It'd be kind of fun.
Yeah, I would. I want to see you up on the stage there, Truman
O'Brien. Listen, I have a thought, and I'm going to talk to you about it off the air, but you and I may be doing
not live.
That
is funny.
But
speaking of which, Kate Dowling just sent me a laugh out loud.
Oh, did she? Yeah. good. Hey, before we get going here, this is the Truman Show today. We don't have a guest. So you guys threw me to the dogs and said, here, go do something. So I kind of made some stuff up. But before we get to that, we should probably check in with everybody and see what they've been up to this week. So, Kevin, let's go ahead and start with you. What's going on?
We have fond memories of our recent vacation trip up into Canada. So, you know, we often visit by boat, and we decided it would be great to visit those same places by car.
Oh.
And so it was kind of fun. We rolled into Heriot Bay, which is H-E-R-I-O-T, Heriot Bay on Quadra Island, which you need to take a ferry to get to. Sounds familiar. And it was great. Some of the people there were like, I thought you looked familiar.
Oh, really? Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah, you know, it's a small community, those folks who operate the Heriot Bay Inn. And we, of course, had always stayed on the boat, and we had a chance now to stay in one of the rooms at the historic hotel built over 100 years ago.
Wow.
And restored to magnificence by a self-appointed group of old hippies. So felt very Vashon.
Oh, that's cool.
Sounds great.
Yeah. It was a lot of fun. Good to be back, of course, but it was a lot of fun to be away.
And how about you, Bruce? What's going on with you?
Oh, been a busy week. You know, if you're a football fan, you had the opportunity to have the extreme highs with the UW game on Saturday.
Exactly.
And the extreme lows with the Seahawks game on Sunday.
Indeed.
So it was a weekend of contrast for Pacific Northwest football, to say the very least. But we did have a very interesting meeting of the Ellisport community to look at the first draft of the signs for the Ellisport Historic Trail that we're developing, similar to the Docton Trail in Docton.
Mm-hmm.
And so hopefully by this summer, we'll have the trail in place and have a grand opening and all those kind of things. So that was very, very interesting. And it's always good to get a community together, because you see people that you see walking by on the street or driving by, but to be in a room together and to be able to sort of touch elbows and just chat with one another was very, very special.
Mm.
The other thing, and this is a PSA for the museum, on Thursday evening at 7 o'clock, the museum talk will be given by Christopher Bryden, from the Puyallup tribe, about the language of the Puyallup tribe.
Mm.
And so it'll be a fascinating evening talk about Tulutseed, which is the language of the Puyallup tribe, which is a variation of Lushootseed, which is the sort of northern language of the Coast Salish people. And Tulutseed is sort of the southern variation of that, sort of like Georgia English versus Boston English, if you will.
Yeah,
the same language, but they're different.
Very different, yeah.
So it should be a great talk.
Really interesting. You know, when I was growing up in high school, I had a fairly sensitive ear. I can hear accents. And just around my little town of Miles City, there were several kind of outlying area, like the Kinsey Project was one of them, and it was a kind of a farming area. And I could recognize kids that were from, you know, the various areas around there. So when I got to college, I thought, oh, man, you know, I'm going to take linguistics. That's got to be a really fascinating topic. Oh, my gosh. phonemes and morphemes or whatever they all were. I could not take it. But the reason I think of that is I look at the writing of these languages and all of these symbols and all. I'm sure that those are phonetic, you know, derivations of the language. So, anyway, that's my comment on phonetic or on linguistics. So, Craig, how about you?
Yeah, Bruce, I hope that talk at the museum will be in English.
Yes.
And not the native languages.
Yeah.
We'd all be in trouble. You know, I have to look at my calendar to remember what I did this last week, because I can't remember what I did yesterday.
Yes.
But last Tuesday after the show, of course, it was Halloween. We were down here for Halloween and then went over at the late over to Snapdragon. Wow, what a night. Vashon really does it every year. Lynette, my wife, and I were handing out candy here in front of the studio, and we occasionally would have to tackle a teenager who would bring a basket and dig it into our basket, and I'd go, no, I can't.
Your tow truck training.
Yes,
right.
Exactly. Yeah. And then on Thursday, I had our Thursday morning scramble, which was dedicated primarily to the Day of the Dead, which is one of my favorite celebrations. It's really one of the wonderful cultural traditions that arose in Mexico and now has spread throughout the entire world. And then this weekend, I went down to visit my brother and sister-in-law and nieces in Oakland. So that was a wonderful visit that I had. Got back Sunday night, and here I am.
All right. And got a little jet lag, you know, going up and down the coast here.
I'll say that. Yeah, that hour and a half riding that jet, knocked me out.
I can understand.
You know,
that,
all those time zones you go through.
yeah. That was the one thing I used to like about flying with Alaska, is primarily up and down the coast. It was not bad. And then we started doing transcons, and those got to be a little harder. I have to say that I think it was 2 weeks ago, I engineered for Linda Nygaard, who's one of our, she has the Clatch, and she used to do Stirring the Pot here on the Voice of Vashon. But she interviewed a gentleman from Nova Scotia. His name is Matt Anderson with a S-E-N. He's a jazz musician. It's hard to say fast. But actually, he's a blues musician more than jazz, but just phenomenal, phenomenal singer. In fact, he performed here on last Thursday at VCA. And for those of you who didn't get to see it, I'm telling you, this guy is just fantastic. He was open, they had an opening act, a gentleman named Adam Baldwin, who played piano and sang all of his own songs. They were a bit morbid, one about a mortuary. but they were great. Matt took the stage, and boy, he just knocked it out. Just terrific singer. And then on Saturday night, I went to VCA again to go to Bruce Ferris's birthday bash. And he had two additional musicians that played with him, Mark Seals on the piano, and John Bishop on the drums. And of course, the jazz drumming is unbelievable. And the musician, the pianist, was just over the top. But anyway, that was a great concert as well. So that was my getting out and about.
That's a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, it was great.
Sit at home, do we?
No. Well, we get out and about,
That's right.
Oh, and I will throw in one more thing. On Sunday night, we went over to my nephew's house, and he had all of his siblings there. There were five of them total, and Molly, my daughter, hadn't seen her cousins in a while, so that was a great fun, too.
That's cool.
Yeah. So anyway, that's my time.
Do you have an opinion as to who the best drummer was that it has ever been?
You know, I think one of my favorites is a guy named Joe Morello. Jazz drummer.
Right.
I'm trying to remember if he played with Dave Brubeck, I think. But, oh, my gosh, just a phenomenal, phenomenal
They
drummer.
Are. They can be absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Do you guys have any favorite drummers, Bruce and Kevin?
Yeah, no? Mine's same as Truman. Played with Dave Brubeck.
It was Dave Brubeck, wasn't it? Yeah. Joe Merle.
Amazing. Sort of, you know, you think of drummers as just sort of banging away, but, you know.
No. They really don't.
And they're just key to holding everything together.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
When they ask musicians who they think is one of the greatest modern-day drummers, mm-hmm. I mean, Gene Krupa comes up, of course.
Yeah, of course.
But the person who oftentimes comes on top is Karen Carpenter.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Right.
Unbelievable drummer.
She was.
Yeah.
Yeah. She had to give it up because she was singing lead, you know. Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, if you read a lot about the Beatles, apparently Ringo Starr was, when he came in, he just transformed the group.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, both Paul McCartney and John Lennon both spoke about how deft he was at sort of bringing the group together, taking this sort of mess and bringing it together. And so, and he's often viewed as kind of the clown of the group.
Yeah.
But in fact, was really the basis for pulling them together in many ways.
Yeah, I'm not going to delay this show any longer, but I do. That reminds me of something.
Yes, please.
On my show on Thursday, like I said, part of the show was dedicated to the Day of the Dead, and the other was dedicated to musical history of what happened on November 2nd.
Oh.
And Stephen Holtz, who was sitting in for Mike Nichols, who was feeling under the weather, we were bantering back and forth, and I said, I got one more song here that occurred on November 2nd. And he goes, oh, well, what year? And I go, this year. And he goes, this year? And I go, yeah, 7 o'clock this morning. He goes, 7 o'clock this morning? And I go, yeah, the Beatles' last song, Now and Then, was released at 7 a.m. our time. And I said, there's another moment in musical history.
Yeah, they used AI to replicate John Lennon's voice, I guess. Yeah, I heard part of it. It was, I don't know.
That wasn't my favorite tune.
No.
But it is kind of interesting that it did involve all four Beatles.
Yeah, exactly. So. Well, it was stuff that George Harrison had recorded earlier, I guess, and that they were able to plug it in there. Well, so today is the 7th of November. It's election day. So, again, want to remind folks to be sure and get your ballots. You can put them in the drop box at the library before 8 o'clock. Or you can put them in the mail before 5 o'clock, so we get them date stamped for today. But I want to be sure you get that. But also, here's one for you. In 1874 was the very first cartoon depicting an elephant as the Republican Party symbol. It was drawn by Thomas Nash. So how about that?
Great political cartoonist.
Yeah. So there you go.
Truman, his name was Nast, N-A-S-T.
Oh, not Nash, it was Nast. Oh, you're right.
And some people think that the word nasty came out of that. Because his cartoons were very pointed and very
cutting,
sharp, if you will, in terms of depicting. He also developed the symbol of the donkey for the Democratic Party.
He did. Okay.
Yeah. So that's those symbols go back to Thomas Nast in that cartoon done in the 1870s, I think, or early 1880s, around the election of Grant and sort of that struggle between the Democrats and the Republicans.
All right. Well, there you go. And also political, 1917 was the October Revolution in Russia, where Lenin and the Bolsheviks seized power and captured the Winter Palace and overthrew the provisional government. So that was 1917.
That's interesting, too. When I took Russian history in college, it was just a few years earlier that one of the presidents of Russia, I think he was a Menshevik, was teaching at Stanford University.
Whoa!
That's how old I am.
Yeah.
But he was like the president for 9 months or something, and then he moved to the United States and he taught for a while at Stanford.
Oh my gosh! So along that same vein, in 1931, the Chinese People's Republic was proclaimed by Mao Zedong. So there you go. We've got all kinds of this
big events.
2000. Of course, was when the controversial election of George Bush over Al Gore It was when the Supreme Court ruled. It was in 2000, November 7th.
The fix was in.
It was in. There it was. And in 2020, of course, Joe Biden was beat. Guess who? Our least favorite president.
Statistically, I think that's just about right.
Well, reluctantly in 2000, all good supporters of democracy went along with the Supreme Court and didn't try to push Bush out of the White House.
Yeah, that's right. Well, there you go.
Point in history.
There it is. You know what? I'm going to kind of go. I've got a bunch of notes here, but we should start with local stuff. And, we've had a couple of pretty interesting wildlife issues in the last few days. Of course, for you folks who are down on the water, the orcas came clear into the Quartermaster Harbor, which was pretty darn cool. Got a whole lot of video and stills off of Jensen Point there. It looks like they came clear in past Jensen Point.
They came right. Yeah. Yeah, they did.
Yeah, all the way in.
And did circles out there.
Yeah, it was reaching and all kinds of stuff. Did anybody get to see it or no? No. Yeah.
Lots of video online, that's
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
And they apparently stayed in the harbor all night. Didn't leave till about 7 a.m. the next morning.
Really?
Yes, which is, not untypical for them to find a refuge like that and to stay for a while.
Darn shallow there. It's only about 30 feet,
the inner harbor, yeah. By the time you get out to Docton, it's in the 40, 50 feet range, but yeah, it's fairly shallow. But,
you've seen orca catch animals on the beach. They don't have too much trouble with shallow water.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. Of course, those are the transient orcas, because our locals only eat fish.
That's right.
Which is kind of, I find that kind of interesting that their diet is completely different from the transients who come in and eat the mammals.
It's really interesting, too. I mean, a little bit of history on that is, orcas have not come into Quartermaster Harbor. I don't remember a recorded incident of coming in for the last 50, 60 years or longer. And one of the stories coming from the Puyallup tribe is that there was a large rock right at the entrance of Quartermaster Harbor that was known as Killer Whale's Mother's Rock. And it was a place where the orcas would often gather. Early settlers blew it up because it was a hazard to navigation. And from that point on, orcas never came into Quartermaster Harbor. And even when they were trying to capture orcas back in the 60s and 70s for SeaWorld and things like that, several times they tried to drive them into Quartermaster Harbor so they could capture them, and they would never go into Quartermaster Harbor. It's interesting if that legend and story has some basis to it, is what has changed, because this is the first time in my memory in 50 years I've been here that I've heard of them coming into the harbor, and I don't know of any before that. Interesting kind of speculation there.
So it got rid of the rock and got rid of the orcas. That's interesting. Interesting. You know, when you said they blew up that rock, it reminded me. Do you know where one of the largest non-nuclear explosions occurred? I think maybe in the world, but for sure in the U.S. or in the northern hemisphere. That was up in the Narrows, up
Campbell River.
Yeah, outside of Campbell River. There was a huge rock. They're talking about a hazard in navigation, and they blew that thing up. I don't know when it was, back in the 40s, maybe?
Something like that, I think.
But I thought that was kind of interesting. I mean,
we're not historians. We don't care about these.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're just trying to get... Yeah, Kevin, go ahead.
Well, I just picked up a book while we were in Canada about the history of a lot of the villages, the seaside villages that are now grown up into towns like Lund and places like the Campbell River, for example. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they had a photograph of the explosion.
Oh, they did.
That rock. And I'd have to go back to the charts to see what the name of that specific spot is. We were basically in that same area as we crossed over to Quadra Island. I think it would have been fascinating to see, you know, the currents that ran through there. There's photographs in this book, of course, but the power of the water as it moves there with such a high tidal exchange further north is pretty impressive. So you can see why they were motivated to take out that hazard to navigation.
Yeah, I know that we used to have a little book in our up in the cockpit that we could point things out, and we had, you know, had all kinds of historical facts, and that was one of the ones that when we flew over the Chatham Straits, is that the name of it? Just suddenly struck me, but anyway, that area there, and we'd read that part of the thing about the explosion. So it was also about the wildlife here on the island. We had a bear up north. Did you guys see that?
Yeah.
Did you guys see it?
Wildlife camera?
Yeah. Well, it was a ring camera, or whatever they call it.
Yeah, at least a real moving little clip.
Yeah, of a black bear that was up, I don't know exactly where it was.
But he said it was up by Winghaven.
Oh, yeah. So, well, Winghaven. That's if he came across Colvos, he'd have to come all the way around the island to
hike a little bit, you know.
Yeah. Interesting.
Somebody online. I'm sorry, Kevin. Go ahead.
Well, I do remember, I can't remember how many years ago it was, but there was a bear on the island. And the thing that I really enjoyed about the Beachcomber is all the tracking of the bear sightings and, you know, based on the day and the time.
Yeah.
And it was pretty amazing how they got around.
Yeah. Well, that bear swam all the way to Des Moines and went all the way the long way and then kept going east, you know, from there. So that was pretty amazing.
I got a kick. Somebody asked on social media, they said, can I go and pet the bear? And somebody responded, yes, but only once.
I was just going to say, once. Well, they had somewhere up in Canada, or I think it was Canada, where they closed one of the trails. Because the tourists wanted to cuddle the cub.
Oh, it's man. Tourist tossing time again.
It is. Kevin.
Well, I do. That does remind me of a story. So a good friend of mine lived with his family up in Snoqualmie Pass area, up in Alpental Valley. And I got to know him pretty well. And we'd spend quite a bit of time together, summer and winter. And in the summertime, the recreation for us teenage boys was to go out to the gas station at the summit and, you know, chew the fat with the folks who were pumping gas for tourists who came up over and truck drivers and so on.
Yeah.
And Clark used to have a good time feeding candy bars to the bear cubs up there.
Wow.
Just behind Smitty's Diner. And the Smitty's Diner was a favorite place for the bears because that was where the dumpsters were, where all the extra food scraps got put out.
Sure.
And I remember some years after knowing that Clark had done this, we're walking through this basically trail, and he's ahead of me 40 or 50 feet. And I'm fiddling around with something. All of a sudden, I hear this rushing in the woods, and I look up, and Clark is running full tilt towards me. And breathing, and there's a bear, there's a bear, there's a bear, there's a bear, and he's flying past me. And I turn around immediately and start running after him and take about five steps and then stop and start laughing out loud because I figured the bear was running equally fast the other direction.
Other direction, that's right. I love it. Okay, so there's our bear stories for the day. You know, I spent a year in beautiful Southeast Asia in Vietnam, obviously. And during the monsoon there, monsoon rains are not like any other rain ever. I mean, it's like standing under a waterfall. I've never seen anything like it. And if you're flying, you'll see just this column of water that's coming out of the sky. You can't see through it. I mean, it is just phenomenal. Well, I got to tell you, the rain that we had just the last couple of days was approaching that. Did you guys experience that too? I mean, man, it was coming down.
And did you guys all hear the thunderbolt that hit?
Oh yeah, one. Just one.
Just one, but it was in somewhere close to Tramp Harbor. everybody I've talked to around the harbor, I mean, our houses were shaking. It was that loud.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're sitting there on the computers, both of us, my wife and I, and she said, was that a flash? And about the time the words came out of her mouth, kaboom! That was, yeah, it was. That was what that was.
Mm-hmm. I missed all that. It was horrible weather down in Oakland, California. It was 75 degrees and sunny.
Yeah, exactly. Just what we wanted to hear. Okay, so, hey, in the state, today is... no, this is not going to be election day for those guys. That's coming up later on. But we do have candidates running for governor, huh? Anybody have any comments about those? What do we have on the Dem side? We've got Bob Ferguson and Hillary Franz. I've met Bob, but does anybody know Hillary or anything about her candidacy? Don't everyone speak at once.
Nothing that any of us want to. Talk about, I guess. I don't know. I don't know.
Well, I will say that Mark Mullett also has his hat in for the Democrats. Mark is currently a senator in the 5th legislative district, which is over on the east side of the lakes, not the east side of the mountains. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be quite interesting to see how the primary works out. There's a lot of speculation about Hillary, who's the, as you mentioned, the commissioner of public lands.
Right.
There've been some concerns over that I've heard about how public lands are administered, but that's I think pretty standard for that job.
Yeah.
Other than that, I suspect that Bob is feeling pretty comfortable in with his name recognition through the state.
Right. So now I'm going to have to show my ignorance. When is the primary for that? It's not now.
It's going to be August. I would have to double check. I actually have that information, but I have to go find it for you.
Okay.
I'll look it up.
Yeah, I was wondering. I didn't think it was.
Who are the Republican candidates or some of them?
Well, Dave Reichert, of course, former district representative for the 8th congressional district, and also a
former head of the Green River Task Force.
Yeah, you've had some experience with.
Yeah, I spent a fair amount of time on the opposite side.
Yeah, of him.
Right.
So we don't want to mention that we know you. We talked to Dave Reichert. Yeah, go ahead, Kevin.
So, it turns out August 6th of 2024, August 6th next year, is the state primary election date, filing date. So there may be more people who put their name in the hat, in the ring, if you will. May 10th is the state filing date for elections. So good space guy. If he doesn't, get that airport commissioner job on
back. Yeah. He could get the right end, that's for sure.
He's got the right name for an airport.
That's right. He does. Yeah. And with our flying saucer, you might come in there. All right.
If I can jump in, I think Dave Reichert's going to be a very serious contender for the governor's race.
Yeah.
I mean, he's very much a Dan Evans kind of Republican. Mm-hmm. He's a strong believer in servant leadership. He did a good job, according to people in his district, when he was in Congress. And he's not a kind of crazy right-wing Republican. That may mean he doesn't get the nomination from the Republican Party in the state of Washington. But if he does, he's going to be a serious contender, I think. Assuming all the sort of MAGA Republicans will vote for him rather than a write-in candidate. So it'll be fascinating to see how that Reichert, Franz, Ferguson sort of process works out through next year. But I see him as a potential Republican governor for the state of Washington. Mm-hmm. I don't think he would win, but I think he's going to give the Democrats a much closer race than they've had it. Over the last 15 or 20 years.
Well, and I think you're the one that posted this, Kevin, that the last Republican governor we had was John Spellman, and that was he left office, in 1885? So that would be a long time being a Democratically run state.
It has been. Well, one other interesting thing won't affect us, I don't think, significantly on the east, on the west side of the mountains, but on the east side of the mountains in around area around Yakima, I believe it's the 15th legislative district, our congressional maps or our state legislative maps, I believe, are likely to be redrawn in Washington state. Hmm. There was some issues raised about whether the maps redrawn after the census are fair to the large Latina population around Yakima, and courts have decided that they weren't fair. Hmm. And so we should see some adjustments there. How it will affect other legislative districts and the balance of, you know, who's competitive in the state, you know, yet to be seen until the new maps come out. But I think you can count on the very likelihood that somebody more representative of the Latin population in the largest area of Latina population in the state is very likely to have a chance to be their representative now.
Yeah,
that is an interesting development. You know, years ago, as you well know, you would have thought that that would have meant that those districts would have a higher Democratic vote. That ain't necessarily so anymore. Mm-hmm. Not sure what reasons, but that's can't count on the Latino vote as a Democrat.
And you know, the other thing I wonder about is that it's we talk about gentrification, all of that area over there, the Prosser and Yakima and the Horse Seven Hills or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, huge wineries are going in there, and how's that going to affect the population as well? Mm. And the fact that we've had the what's the word that they're using? The flight from the cities, anyway, to getting out people working from home. I know that the property values in that valley have really gone up, I mean, sizably, because there's so many people moving there because they can work from home and they don't have to be in the city. So, anyway, mm-hmm. It's going to be interesting to see what that what the effect of that's going to be. Go ahead.
I can pick up on that for a second. It's sort of like, you know, it's a lot of demographers are starting to talk about it as the great exurbanization, just like there was a great suburbanization after World War II, and you know, people moved to the suburbs, and you know, cities expanded dramatically. Right now, we're in the beginnings of what a lot of people are seeing, a lot of demographers are seeing, as the exurbanization, where people are taking urban values and moving into these former rural areas, and essentially demanding the kind of rural amenity, I mean, the urban amenities, right, that many rural areas didn't have. So the Starbucks and the coffee shops and the bakeries and the, you know, the theaters and the movie houses are really beginning to transform along the lines that you talked about, Truman. So it's a really interesting phenomena that we're just at the beginning of, and it may be a significant transformation of American culture and politics, as was the suburbanization of the 1950s and 60s.
I'm curious, Bruce, in recounting that, what's the motive for that move? Is it the sources you're referring to talk about why that's happening?
Yeah, I mean, it's largely what Truman mentioned. People can work remotely. Mm-hmm. I mean, part of it's a function of the aging of the American population, more and more people retiring, more and more people going into semi-retirement where they don't need to work full time. And they're moving into areas where they can have lifestyle choices, in effect. You know, they're moving into rural areas, or they're moving to the Sun Belt, although that may not continue, depending on climate change. But it's the sense that people are not tied to urban environments in the way that they were. And the other side of that is what's happening with downtown retail space and downtown office space. Mm. You know, it's sort of, there's a major sort of crisis developing in urban sort of land and property values because of that. And the other side of it is what we're seeing here on Vashon and in Yakima and in Prosser and, you know, Winthrop and places like that. you know, where prices are going up dramatically because people who come from urban environments with resources can afford to buy houses and pushing houses up.
So that gets us to a national question then, and that is, how is that going to affect the Electoral College? I mean, is how are, because right now, I mean, supposedly the reason for the whole Electoral College is because of the trying to give equal weight to those, you know, those suburban, those not suburban, but the
rural,
thank you, communities. So how's that going to affect, you know, are we going to change that or any comments about that? I know we've talked about that a little bit in the past, but.
Well, you know, my sense is what it's doing is it's turning a lot of those deep red states into potentially purple states, particularly in certain communities within those states. That I don't think it's going to shift the Electoral College kind of votes significantly, right. But you're beginning to see a shift in that direction. I don't think for the next 2, 3, 4 presidential elections we'll see that impact, but essentially all over the United States, areas are becoming more purple, even states like Texas, that's a pretty deep red state. When you look at the counties and when you look at the distribution of votes, it's becoming closer and closer. And that's why the Republicans, in my mind, that's why the extreme MAGA Republicans are so intense on getting away from democracy and getting toward autocracy, because they know they can't win.
Yeah, with that kind of
And I'm not sure. You know, I'm not sure what it takes to change the Electoral College. I assume that it's a constitutional change, which, if I recall right, is 2/3 majority of each house, and maybe even more. And so, I personally don't see that. There is still possibility of the National Interstate Compact, I think, which basically says, and Washington has signed up, that says if the popular vote goes to a presidential candidate and is opposite of the state vote, then the state electors will support the winner of the popular vote. Right. Now, the right. Interstate Compact is not ratified by enough states to come into effect at this point. But what if it were to be ratified by enough states, then basically the national popular vote winner would presumably become the president every election. The only caveat is the challenges that would be put forward in court as to whether or not your electors could be different than what your state population voted for. But other than that, I guess I don't see any near-term changes to the Electoral College, but it certainly would change the vote.
Well, and if that occurs, it basically negates negates the whole idea of the Electoral College, right? Because
that's the underlying theory, is that that power granted to smaller states would not be there, and basically we would go with the popular vote and some claim, myself included, a truer democracy.
All right, so one more thing about Election Day. I know there's a couple of big contest in Ohio and what was the other, Virginia, I believe, and primarily about the abortion rights. Craig, since you're an ex-Ohioan, do you have any comments about that?
Kentucky as well has a big one.
Right.
Ohio, as many of you know, an issue on the ballot about instilling the right to abortion in their constitution, preserving it forever. It'll be a real test. It was not that long ago that Ohio rejected an attempt to up the percentage that was necessary to change the constitution from a simple majority to more of a supermajority. And that failed. The supporters of abortion rights prevailed on that one, and now the question is whether or not that momentum continues. We'll see whether or not this new provision passes, along with legalizing recreational marijuana.
Well, that's on the ballot there as well.
Yep.
Well, you know, I mean, this could portend some big changes for the 2024.
Well, there's a number of things going on here. The Beshear governor's race in Kentucky is a real, symbol of what might be happening. To have a Democrat as the governor as long as they've had there with a very, very Republican state that just went for Trump by, I don't know, 28% or some ridiculous amount like that. So we'll see, because, and I'll be quiet after this. It seems like it's really come down to the public puts their trust in the Republicans on issues of economy and crime. And we could argue about whether or not that makes any sense.
Yes, we could.
But in terms of personal rights and values, they are putting their trust in the Democrats. So we'll see what prevails.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, Kentucky will be very interesting, partly because Mitch McConnell, who was up for reelection, I believe in 2020, might have been 2022, who was claimed to be the least popular U.S. senator. And of course, he is the House minority or the Senate minority leader today. And he's the senior senator from Kentucky. But the theory of if you're unhappy with your Republican senator, will you vote for a Democrat, didn't pan out at that point. But the intriguing thing to me about this race in Kentucky, with any statewide race, is that all the gerrymandering that occurs in the legislative districts and that can affect the makeup of the state legislators does not apply, right? Because everybody in the state has a chance to vote for those state elected officials like the governor. So it'd be quite intriguing to see if that does represent a shift in the sort of the values and the political alignment of folks in Kentucky.
Well, you know, if you look at Montana, also you've got John Tester, who's a Democrat, and, you know, Montana being a very red state, he's been reelected several terms now. And now the question is he going to go get it one more time? And I know he's putting the hard press on, yes.
Well, in Mississippi, you know, you've got the Elvis Presley factor.
Right, yeah.
Second cousin to Elvis running for governor.
Or once removed cousin, anyway, yeah. Yeah, well, you never know. Go ahead, Kevin.
Another state that has a similar situation is West Virginia, with Joe Manchin as a Democrat senator. In a very Republican state. And looking at the upcoming 2024 race, we're a year out now, a year and a day, because I think we have a leap year between us and that election, is that Joe Manchin, I think, is perceived as the most vulnerable Democratic senator who will be up for election in 2024. And I did have a chance to talk to some of my very liberal and progressive colleagues about whether they thought they'd be interested in helping Joe Manchin get reelected. And universally, there was not a lot of enthusiasm.
I was going to say, I didn't think there would be.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, speaking to now that we're looking at 2024 in the presidential, what do you think about Gavin Newsom? It sounds like he's getting more and more closer to maybe throwing his hat in the ring.
Well, he may get the opportunity. There are more and more pundits and Democratic advisors or whatnot that are suggesting that Biden, because of some of the visuals, and they don't want Biden primaried. That could really weaken all the chances. But they're really looking at asking Biden to retire.
Yeah,
and if he did so, who would jump in? And Newsom, in many polls in many states, is second behind Biden.
And of course, you're talking about Manchin. He's even been touted as a possible candidate as well. So this is going to get interesting. Kevin, mm-hmm. You're about to say something.
Yeah, Manchin on the no labels ticket, which would basically be running as an independent, or I'm not sure how exactly they'd frame their candidacy because they don't align with either the Democrat or the Republican Party. Interestingly, in Washington State, for Secretary of State, there was a person running unaffiliated with either party on the contention that neither party deserves your vote, so vote for me, I'm independent of either one of them. And intriguingly, looking at the campaign staff as well as the donor staff, the donors for that particular person were very highly aligned with conservative interests. Hmm. So it'll be quite intriguing to me to see to what extent that is a attempt for conservatives to sidestep the dilemma they're in with the
MAGA movement
supporting Trump.
Yeah,
yeah, and the MAGA, yeah. The MAGA faction. So, see, always a surprise in American politics, right?
We haven't mentioned Virginia. Virginia is considered by many to be the true litmus test. Youngkin, mm-hmm. Governor Youngkin has not had the whole House, you know, the whole legislature there. And he's considered a reasonable Republican, a more acceptable Republican, especially people in the middle of the road, although it's going to be a real test of abortion rights because he's an advocate of barring abortion after 15 weeks. So that's a fascinating race.
And so therefore the Ohio situation will be very telling. I heard it characterized this morning as, you know, do women's reproductive rights issues still carry the day in of, you know, a significant part of the electorate in American politics? And I would hazard to say, heck yes.
Yeah.
You know, some things that the media questions, I question why they question them. The hijinks going on in the Republican-controlled Ohio, we hadn't mentioned that earlier, but I think people have probably heard it. A significant number of people dismissed from the voting rolls. I think the day before you had to reapply to get your voter registration, as well as the language on the ballot. My guess is that the issue has such high visibility that all those attempts at distraction, I think, are going to fail. Yeah. And I think the Ohio measure will be supported by Ohio voters.
So that gets us back to the 14th Amendment. Thoughts about Colorado and Minnesota and where that's going. Any thoughts on that? Craig, I'm particularly interested in what you think about
that. I'm interested if anybody else does. I have thoughts. And they are basically that I think people that's going to turn into more of a political issue than a legal one. The courts will probably kind of do a too hot to handle approach to it, and let it run its way up to the Supreme Court. But I don't think anything will be resolved in either of those two states, unfortunately. Although there's a very good argument, but there's something that doesn't sit well with people equity wise. Even though it's a disqualification, it's not a penalty for wrongdoing. It's nuanced, and I think it's not going to be picked up by most people.
Don't think it's going to fly, huh? All right.
Well, here's some thoughts I'd like to add to that, because in addition to this disqualification, if you've ever been an insurrectionist after having sworn an oath to support the country, or given aid and comfort to those who have, which is Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which is the disqualification statute that's now being reviewed, there's other qualifications to run for president in the country. You need to be 35 years or older, and you need to, I think, also be a U.S. citizen. So, you know, one of the arguments against this disqualification is let the people decide. Why do we have to worry about the Constitution? It's really the people who should decide, to which I say, let's put a 12-year-old on the ballot and see, let the people decide if it's okay for that 12-year-old to run. and then, you know, see what might happen.
That's a very good point, Kevin. I when I used to do criminal defense work, somebody'd say to me, oh, they got off on a technicality. And I go, that technicality is the Constitution of the United States.
That's right. Right. It's probably a pretty good reason to get off on that. All right, got one more topic here, and that is this coming Saturday is the 11th, is Veterans Day. In 1918, World War I armistice was signed by the Allies in Germany into effect, and hostilities ended at 11 o'clock, so it's the 11th hour, the 11th day of the 11th month. And Bruce, when did Armistice Day become a national holiday, and when did it become Veterans Day, and why? Do you know?
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's very next year, 1919, we began to celebrate Remembrance Day. And it's still celebrated as a big day around the world, at least the Western world. But in 1926, Congress actually passed a resolution that the president should issue a annual proclamation to observe November 11th with quote unquote appropriate ceremonies. And then, so that sort of became officially recognized. In 1938, it became a federal holiday. And Veterans Day itself wasn't celebrated as Veterans Day until 1954. So it was an 8-year effort led by a World War II veteran named Raymond Week to have Armistice Day recognize all veterans, not just the veterans of the Great War or World War I. And so since November 11th, 1954, we have annually celebrated Veterans Day on November 11th. Hmm. But a lot of places in the world celebrate it not as Veterans Day, but as a Memorial Day or a Remembrance Day, and still base it on that end of World War I. As you said, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month.
Oh, that's interesting. And I find that interesting that other countries would celebrate that as well or honor that day as well.
If I could jump in with one more thing. There'll be an article in the Beachcomber this Thursday recognizing the six veterans memorials on Vashon Island. There's a memorial monument in the Vashon Cemetery that was put in as a result of World War I, but recognized the Civil War and the Spanish-American War veterans. And then with each war, a plaque has been added to that. There's also the World War II Island Roll of Honor at the Heritage Museum. There's the Bacchus Memorial Garden, which is behind the Senior Center, which to me is a disgrace because it's filled with vehicles and it's filled with storage sheds and you can't even see the Bacchus Memorial. But that's another issue for me to deal with in the future. There's a Harold Agron Memorial Park, which was Agron Park was really dedicated to Harold Agron, who was a veteran killed in World War II. His parents gave that land to the island for community park. There's the Vashon Vietnam Memorial in Ober Park. And then there's the Robert Bennison Memorial at Vashon High School. So there's six memorials here on
the island.
What
about yours, Truman, at the Troll?
There is. There's one.
There is, yeah.
Yeah, that's a World War II, I believe, also.
Which one is that?
The one that's in the garden or in the I don't know what you call it, the park there before you get to the Troll. Up to the
Point Robinson.
Yeah, Point Robinson.
Is that a veterans memorial?
Yeah. Captain Joe was telling us about that recently. It's a World War II memorial. Is that right, Captain Joe? The one that's in at Point Robinson, the memorial that's there?
No, it's Vietnam.
Oh, it is Vietnam. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was World War II. Vietnam. Right. Yeah, you have to walk back to it, but it is
it's Vietnam. It's the large concrete memorial
by
the Troll.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And by the way, I have to say that I was a park commissioner when we did the one in Ober Park and was kind of instrumental in pushing that one through. So that was pretty proud of that. Al Bradley did the work on the basalt columns and it was pretty cool.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was pretty fun. Okay, hey guys, next week is, November is the National American Heritage Month, and so next week we're going to have, is there someone from the Puyallup tribe, Bruce, that's going to be here? Do we know who yet?
We're supposed to, yes.
So okay.
I'll know later this week.
All right, so be sure to tune in for that. So for Kevin, Bruce, Craig, and me, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will see you all next week.
Have a great week.
Okay, thanks, guys. You bailed me out on that one.
Oh, oh no, you did great.
Oh, well, it was
nicely done.
Thanks. Yeah. It was. I don't like this hosting stuff. It's too dang much work.
It's just a red button and asking a question or two.
Yeah, right.
You throw out, chum on the water, and we're going to pick it up.
That's true with this group. That's for sure. Well, four old white guys, what can you expect, you know?
That's right. I thought you were going to talk about how the clash was, four white women.
Five old white women.
Which I guess, Bruce, you get credit for that analogy.
Yeah.
Well, we can talk about that next week after the show at lunch.
Exactly. We will do that. All right, guys. See y'all next week.
All right, bye.
You guys. Bye.
Nice to be with you. Captain.
Good afternoon,
bye, Captain.